Tonight we're going to start a discussion about the prophets. There are four major prophets: Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. And then there are 12 minor prophets that are the last 12 books of the Old Testament. They were things that were written to the United Kingdom when Israel and Judah were together. And when Israel and Judah are together, they're referred to as Israel. And then they were written, some of them were written to the two nations that emerged in the divided kingdom period. And those two nations, well, the 10 are called Israel, or sometimes they're called Ephraim. And the two are called Judah. So it's a little confusing when we talk about Israel. You have to be careful to distinguish between Israel in the United Kingdom, Israel in the divided kingdom period. Some of the prophets were written to non-Israelites, people that were not associated with the nation of Israel. And that's an indication, at least in my mind, that God had expectations for the city of Nineveh that had been expressed to them somewhere. I don't know where. They're not recorded for us. And Jonah was enforcing those expectations for the Ninevites. Jonah wasn't enforcing the expectations that God had for either Israel in the United Kingdom period, or for Ephraim, or for Judah in the divided kingdom period. So what that tells me is God is a God of the world. He is not a tribal God, which was kind of the way that Israel felt about God, but it was, of course, improper. There are portions of other books that are written to deal with those nations, the last half of Ezekiel, parts of Daniel, of course, written to deal with Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians, and parts of Ezekiel that are written to deal with just a whole raft of other nations. But the parts that are written to Israel or to Ephraim or to Judah were written in a really relatively short period in Israel's overall history. They were written between about 760 and 460. And remember, this is BC, so the numbers are getting smaller as we go. This was a period when there was a tremendous amount of political, military, economic, social upheaval. Things were not going the way that they should have been going. There was tremendous unfaithfulness in both Israel and Judah, although it was more pronounced in Israel. Ted has demonstrated that for us in our discussions of Jeremiah. And because there was so much unfaithfulness to their covenant that they had made with God, God had to send enforcement agents for the covenant. And the enforcement agents were the prophets. It was also a time when there was a shift in the balance of power internationally. The balance of power was shifting away from Egypt, shifting to the north. So there is no statement anywhere in the prophets that explains why they were mostly written during this 300-year period. But these are just some observations that we can make about that period. And of course, still being aware that there was a 400-year period that followed the last of the prophets, Malachi, when God did not speak by prophets. So we call that the 400 silent years. So this is some of the last material that we have from Israel's history before we switch over to the coming of Jesus and the new kingdom period. Well, we always talk about them as minor and major prophets. The major prophets, Ezekiel, Daniel, Isaiah, and Jeremiah, are only called major prophets because they're longer than the rest. In fact, the Jews, and Stuart and Fee point this out, the Jews typically combine the minor prophets into a single book that they called the 12. And if you took that single book, which was a collection of all the minor prophets and what they had said, and you combined it and you compared it to the major prophets, it's longer than two of them and shorter than two of them. So it's right in the middle. So minor and major prophets doesn't really say anything about their importance. A lot of the really important phrases and prophetic statements that have to do with the coming of the Messiah are statements that come from the minor prophets. I find it interesting when I look at the prophets to make an observation that an awful lot of our contemporaries spend an awful lot of time talking about the prophets. In fact, they spend so much time talking about the prophets that you would think that the prophets were writing really for our benefit, but in reality, less than 2% of the statements that the prophets made are messianic or dealt with what the kingdom was going to look like during the Messiah's reign. Less than 5% deal with the new covenant period. That's the period that we live in. And less than 1% of the prophets refer to events that have not happened yet. So when we talk about the prophets, we talk about a group of people that make up a large portion of the written record of our dealings with God. And at the same time are, in my mind, more frequently misunderstood than almost any other group of or genre of writing in the entirety of the Bible. I do find it interesting that when we talk about the prophets, we don't very often talk about some of the prophets that didn't write a book for us. Two that come to mind are Elijah and Elisha. And we don't read anything that Elijah and Elisha wrote. What we do have concerning Elijah and Elisha are the things that they did. There are a couple of prophets that were kind of a combination of speakers and doers. And so you have the prophet Gad, and you have the prophet Nathan, and the prophet Huldah, and you have Daniel, and you have Jeremiah. But for the most part, we don't know very much about the prophet. What we know about is what the prophet said that God told them to say. So we're talking about essentially a literary genre. The second thing that we can say about the nature of prophecy is that the prophets were best characterized as spokesmen for God. And they were talking to their contemporaries. They were giving them some information that they had to have. The best way to think about the prophets, in my mind, is to think about the prophets as covenant enforcement officers or covenant enforcement mediators. We talked a little bit about the covenant last time. That's what we call the law. And we pointed out that covenants, generally speaking, whatever the covenant was, and specifically talking about the covenant that existed between God as the king and Israel as the subjects, the covenants were corporate documents. They were written to a group of people. They were not written, generally speaking, to an individual. And they contained certain stipulations. They were expressed as laws. That's what we're familiar with when we think about law. But then they also contained sanctions, or they contained blessings that would be contingent upon faithfulness and curses that would be contingent upon unfaithfulness. So the blessings in the law, in the covenant, are generally to be found in three places: Leviticus 26, Numbers 4, and Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 4, and Deuteronomy 28. And the blessings, generally speaking, again, fall into about six really large categories of blessings. You had agricultural abundance, you had life, health, prosperity, respect, and safety. So that's when God made the covenant with Israel and he expressed the requirements, he also expressed the blessings that would come from faithfulness to the requirements that were a part of the covenant. The blessings are as much a part of the covenant as the requirements are. And then you also had curses. And the curses are associated with unfaithfulness. If you refuse to keep the covenant, this was going to be the consequence. It was a curse in this case. If you were unfaithful, you were cursed. Again, three places: Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 4, and Deuteronomy 28. And I like the way that Stewart and Fee summarize the categories of curses under what they call the 10 D's. You have death, disease, drought, dearth, or famine, danger, destruction, defeat, deportation, destitution, or disgrace. So you have the curses as a group. You have the blessings as a group. But sometimes the prophets would make reference to only a couple of the curses. But when they referred to a couple of the curses, of course, Israel understood that that really meant all 10. But one or the other was going to stand out in Israel's experience at that time. It's critical to remember when you read the prophets, and I think this is the biggest thing we have to remember about the prophets. The prophets didn't invent the curses or the blessings that they announced to Israel. You could think about somebody like Jeremiah, chapters 27, 28. Tough thing for Jeremiah. He has to tell the children of Israel that God is now expecting them to submit to the Babylonians. Now, they don't want to do that. But listen to the way that Jeremiah describes what he's doing. Jeremiah is not making this up. This is what God said to Jeremiah. So in chapter 27, at verse 2, you see the statement. Jeremiah says, "Thus saith Jehovah to me." In chapter 27, at verse 4, "Give them a charge unto their masters, saying, thus and thus and thus." And he's talking about the people that had come to Jeremiah. He's going to give them the information and send them back home and tell them to tell those who are their masters. And then he kind of concludes that section in Jeremiah 27 with the statement, "saith Jehovah." So this is not something that Jeremiah is making up. And it's not because Jeremiah is such an astute observer of the situation around Israel that he says, "Hey, the Babylonians are way more powerful than we are. There's no sense in resisting them because they're just going to kill us. So just accept the fact that the Babylonians are stronger than we are." This was something that God decided, and Jeremiah just reported it. And it's important that we understand that if a prophet took on this role of being a spokesman for God on his own, without God calling him to do this, we were to regard that, the Israelites were to regard that person as a false prophet. And they were not supposed to listen to those prophets that took that office on their own. So it seems like when you read the prophets and their announcement of blessings and curses, there's a typical pattern. When you talk about the curses, first thing that the prophets do is they identify Israel's sin or Israel's unfaithfulness or how Israel has broken its covenant. And then they identify the curse that God is going to bring. When it's blessings, the first thing they do, the prophets, is they identify God's love. And then they identify what the blessing is. And I'm still sort of wrestling with the idea that when they identify curses, the emphasis is on Israel and what Israel has done in being unfaithful. When they identify blessings, the emphasis is on God. Now that is not something that I've completely solidified in my own thinking. It's just something that occurs to me as I read through what the prophets did. We sometimes think of the prophets as if they were radical social reformers, and they really weren't. What they were telling the people was something that God had already identified in the covenant law. When God gave the covenant, he expressed the stipulations, he expressed the sanctions. And all the prophets are doing is calling the people back to what God had expected. So their purpose is not social reform. Now, they did say that Israel had become wicked, and that expressed itself in the social conditions in Israel. And if you read Homer Haley's book on the Minor Prophets, you see a great emphasis on the need for social reform. But their purpose was not social reform. It was to call the people back to God and what God expected them to be. So you find the prophets expressing the stipulations and the blessings and the curses in ways that look different from the way that they're expressed in the law. So the language is a little bit different. They talk about it in novel ways, but they do it in novel ways, not so that they can introduce something new. They do it so that the people will listen to them. And let me take just a minute as an aside. I think that's the function of the preacher today, not to come up with a new idea, but to express the things that God has expressed, perhaps in novel ways by rephrasing them or addressing them to the attention of their hearers so that it sometimes looks like it's new. Enough about preaching. Most of the prophets, and this is something that Ted has spoken of when he talked about the introduction to the book of Jeremiah, consist of a collection of spoken, what Stuart and Fee called oracles, or spoken something like a paragraph. It's always struck me as being really hard to read the prophets cover to cover. But Stuart and Fee, I think, kind of shed some light on that when they point out that they were never really intended to be read cover to cover. These were oracles that were given at a specific time, and then they're all brought together into one book, and they're not necessarily in chronological order. The last time I taught Jeremiah, I tried to teach it in chronological order, and I was so befuddled. Sometimes you can identify the time when a specific paragraph refers to, because there are markers. It was in the 13th reign of this year of the reign of this king, or it was in the 12th year of the reign of this other king. Most of the time, there's a lack of markers, and the best that we can do is identify the social circumstance that the prophet is talking about, and then look at Israel's history and see if we can find a time during Israel's history when that circumstance arose. But it's very difficult. So when you read the prophets, you're going to have to do two things. And we've kind of talked about this before. Read it with an idea to understand the major divisions or specific oracles. You have to ignore the chapter divisions. You have to ignore the verse divisions. And sometimes you can make use of the translators' inserted topic ideas. Remember that those topical idea markers are not part of the original text. That's something that the translators put in because they think that that signifies a break. So it's really hard to read, and it's very hard to teach Jeremiah. And I'm glad that Ted is doing it and not me. But you have to be aware that it was not written in one setting, cover to cover, but instead it was a collected group of statements that the prophets made. I hope that helps. It's a hard concept for me to grasp sometimes. I can't tell you how old I was. Well, I'd be embarrassed to tell you how old I was before I realized that the prophets didn't follow chronologically the kings. I don't know why I got that impression, but I did get that impression, and I thought that the minor prophets followed the major prophets because that's the way they are in the Bible. The Bible is not organized chronologically, and I wish that I had recognized that earlier in my journey with God, because it would have helped me to avoid a lot of mistaken ideas. So the prophets take on some really interesting literary forms. But the literary forms that the prophets take on are appropriate to someone who is functioning as a covenant enforcer. I'll let that sink in a little bit. The literary forms are appropriate to someone who is a covenant enforcer. Prophets, we most of the time when we think about the word prophecy, we think about foretelling the future. That's really not the function that the prophets had. The prophets were spokesmen for God, and they talked about what was going to happen in relatively in the immediate future. They weren't really talking very often about what was going to happen centuries down the road. So let's talk a little bit about some of the forms, the literary forms that you see in the prophets. I was watching a show on PBS within the last couple of days it was a show that discussed a decrease in violence. And the way that they did that was they looked at the recordings of British courts, and they had 17 million words that were recorded about proceedings in British courts. And when they looked at the proceedings, they were able to see some changes in the way that people thought. Early on, they noted that the court proceedings typically focused on not violence that had been done, but things that had been stolen. So someone might have, for instance, stabbed someone else and stolen his purse. And the thing that he's accused of in court is stealing the purse, not stabbing the individual. And then you go on through history and you get to the point where there's a kind of a shift in the way people were thinking about it. And later on in British history, if you read those court proceedings, you see that shift play out this way. Someone stabs an individual, steals his purse, and the thing that he's accused of in court is not stealing the purse, but stabbing the individual. So the focus is on the elimination of violence. So I say all of that because we have to learn about what was going on in Israel when we read the lawsuit form that the prophets used. And Isaiah chapter 3 is one of those sections of the prophets that's written as a covenant lawsuit. So to understand Isaiah 3, you have to understand God is the plaintiff. He's the prosecuting attorney. He's the judge. And he's the bailiff. I don't know if you remember or if you've ever watched the movie A Few Good Men. That's one of those movies where the prosecuting attorney is serving as the bailiff, and he's serving as the attorney at the same time. So here you've got, in this covenant lawsuit, you've got God. He's the prosecuting attorney. He's the plaintiff. He's the judge, and he's the bailiff, and the defendant is Israel. So typical of these covenant lawsuits, you have the summons to come to court, the accusation, if you will. You have the specific charge that's made, the evidence that supports the charge is given, and then you see the verdict pronounced. So we see that a lot in the writings of the prophets. And I have a good friend, John Licking, who has looked at the entirety of the book of Revelation as if it was written from a covenant lawsuit perspective. And he identifies all of those parts. And these covenant lawsuits would have been typical of those agreements that existed between people and the king, even outside of the biblical information. So then you have another literary form. This is in the second chapter of Habakkuk, and it's a woe statement, W-O-E. The Israelites used to scream this word, woe, whenever they were facing disaster or death. And the time that they would scream it most loudly was when they were mourning at a funeral. In our country, our habit is to be a little bit more restrained at a funeral than you typically see at funerals in the Middle East. You see the procession through the street, and you see the people preceding the casket, and they're beating their chest, and they're screaming, and they're crying at the top of their lungs. And sometimes I have to say, I look at that and I think, what'd you do? Pay somebody to go out in front of the casket and just scream at the top of his lungs and beat on himself? Because it almost seems kind of artificial to me. Now, understand, this kind of woe pronouncement didn't seem artificial at all to Israel. And it has typically two parts. First, there's the announcement of the distress that we're in. And then the second part of that is the reason for the distress. And the part of that that has to be understood is, you did something, and that's what's causing the distress. It was unfaithfulness that you had exhibited to the covenant that is causing the distress. So you see that a lot in the prophets, particularly in the book of Habakkuk. And interestingly, you see those woes again in the book of Revelation. We're not specifically thinking about the book of Revelation tonight. We'll talk about that a little bit more at a later date. Then you have salvation statements. And typical of this kind of literary statement is Amos, the 9th chapter. And it has several parts. It's a reference to what God is going to do to bless Israel again. But this is contingent upon Israel making a radical change, and then it specifies what blessings are going to come. So It's a salvation statement. These are, in many ways, these tend to be very hopeful statements. The woe are oracles, the lawsuit form, tends to be, in a sense, very depressing, because those are the pronouncement of curses. Not so common in the prophets, although it happens more than I tend to think, is the enactment oracle, or what I call a visual aid oracle. And you see this in Isaiah, the 20th chapter. Isaiah is told by God to appear stripped and barefoot for 3 years. So he does that. And I know that what he's trying to get Israel to see is that the Assyrians took the Egyptians stripped and barefoot, made them march back to Assyria. And the part of this that you have to kind of understand is that if the Assyrians could do this to Egypt, which was the political power at the time, don't think that you're saved. God is in charge, not political power. And so you have these visual presentations. You don't get that real often, but it does occur. Then you have a messenger speech. This is like the diplomatic messenger who comes from a different place, and he announces something to the people from the king of this other place. So these messenger speeches are really, in many ways, pretty straightforward. It's just the prophet saying, God told me to tell you this. And so then he goes into telling what he's supposed to tell. And again, remember, the prophets didn't invent these things. What the prophets were talking about wasn't new stuff. It may have been expressed in a different way than it was expressed in the giving of the covenant. But what the prophets were saying was, this is what the covenant says. And the king who gave you this covenant sent me here to tell you these things. And then you have poetry. I have to tell you, I'm not a poetry guy. And maybe somebody like Carol, who taught English, has a lot more appreciation for poetry than I do. I'm confident that Kim has much more appreciation for poetry than I do. I find poetry very hard to read. But I think the poetry had a really important purpose. You have to remember that when the prophets were doing their work, most people didn't know how to read and write. And you didn't have movable type. Gutenberg's Bible had not been printed. You didn't have the printing press. The production of the printed word was a time-consuming, exacting process. And the only access that most people had to the written word was when they came to Israel, came to Jerusalem three times a year, and the prophets would gather everyone together and they would read to them what was written on the page that they were holding. So why use poetry? Well, it turns out that having rhythm or meter and having some kind of balance in the language makes it easier to remember these things. Not long before he passed away, my dad recited the entirety of KCF Bath. Now, he had learned that when he was in elementary school. And when he recited that for us, he was in his 80s. If you're not literary and you can't just pick up your Bible and read it, then something that's easily remembered becomes critically important. You know, I mean, I see that in my own life. I live with computers. And there was a time when I was preaching that my memory was very good for most of the New Testament. But now I don't have to rely on memory. I can immediately search for a particular word or phrase or topic, and it'll come up on my computer. So I don't have to rely on memory nearly so much. Maybe that's a shortcoming that we have, but it's just an indication that that's the way that we work. So when you're talking to a pre-literary world, whatever you're telling them has to be easily committed to memory. And so most of the prophets and the things that they had to say lent themselves to listening as opposed to reading. And I know and very well aware that when you read what's written on a page, it sounds fake. It's because most of us don't just typically talk the way that we write. So the prophets were spoken, and it wasn't so much rhyme. Rhyming always seemed like an artificial imposition on the language. For instance, the King James translation is all written in a poetic form, but it's a poetic form called iambic pentameter that has to do with the meter of the writing. And if you know that and you read the King James translation as if it was poetry, and you divide it into lines, and each line has a meter, an iambic pentameter meter, 5 beats in the line, and it goes ba-bump, bump, bump, bump. It makes it a whole lot easier to remember what the King James is saying. So when we talk about Old Testament poetry, Hebrew poetry, we're not talking about rhymes. We're talking about the importance of rhythm and balance, because you could listen to it and it kind of stuck in your head and you could repeat it. So when we talk about Hebrew poetry, you have three essential types of Hebrew poetry. You have a type where the second line reinforces the first line. It just kind of amplifies it a little bit. It doesn't give you any new information. It just kind of repeats it. And because people didn't realize this about Hebrew poetry, a lot of paintings were done during the Dark Ages, during the Middle Ages under the watchful oversight of the Inquisition. And when they painted Jesus in the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, because the Old Testament prophet talked about Jesus coming into the city, riding upon a colt and upon a colt, the foal, or upon an ass and upon the colt, the foal of an ass. A lot of those prophets were interpreted by the Inquisition because they didn't understand this idea of synonymous parallelism. They thought Jesus was riding on two animals. Now, that's kind of foolish, but if you look at the paintings, a lot of the artists couldn't figure out how to portray Jesus riding on two animals, but they would portray him riding on an animal that had eight legs. And it's because they didn't understand synonymous parallelism. The second line repeats the first one. You see that, for instance, in Isaiah 44, verse 22. Then you have antithetical parallelism. If synonymous parallelism looks like this, first line, second line, antithetical parallelism is first line and then a contrast in the second line. So it contrasts the thought that was expressed in the first line. Hosea 7 in verse 14 is an example of that. And then you have what's called synthetic parallelism. Synthetic means you put the two things together. The second line over here is adding information to the first line. So if you think about them, you have synonymous parallelism like this, antithetical parallelism that looks like this, and then you have synthetic parallelism that looks like this. Two bits of information. And Obadiah, the 21st verse, is one of the places that you see that. So let's get down to some general rules about how to understand the prophets. When we talk about understanding the prophets, it's always important to understand the situation that the prophets were addressing. And sometimes they give us historical markers, and we can then consult the history of that period, and we can see what the social situation was during that period. But the prophet's primary task, and this is what we have to remember, was not to predict the distant future, but the relatively immediate future. And from our perspective in 21st century Eugene, that's the past. So the prophet might have written now, and he's predicting what's going to happen in the next 15 years. He's not really concerned with what's going to happen 2,500 years later. So that, for the most part, is what the prophets did. Now, it is true that the Bible generally talks about God acting in contemporary history in a way that's consistent with the way that he's going to act to carry out his overall plan. And we usually talk about God's overall plan, how things are going to look all the way up to the end of recorded time, as being eschatology. Soterology is the study of salvation. Eschatology is the study of what things are going to look like at the very end of time. So when God looks at the overall span of human history, what you see very often is God makes a statement to ancient Israel that judgment is coming upon you in the next 15 years. Now, what we know is that judgment came a number of different times. And when we think about judgments that have come, in many ways, the judgments are all alike. Ancient Israel was not prepared for the judgment that was coming. They were warned about it. They were told about it, but they didn't repent. They didn't prepare themselves for the coming judgment. And so it happens that way in the future. We're warned about judgments. We don't prepare ourselves for the coming judgment, and we'll be taken just as unprepared as they were. So you see a statement like the statement that Peter makes, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. People in Noah's day didn't believe God. And at the end of time, when Jesus comes back, there will be a lot of people who didn't believe God either. But that's not to say that what Noah said was said for our benefit. Now, there are some things we learned from it, but it wasn't said to us. And there are some cases where a prophetic statement clearly has a second meaning. And Stuart and Fee give you the example of the Apostle Paul talking about the Israelites getting water out of the rock. And then the Apostle Paul says the rock that followed them was Christ. So there is a second meaning, but it's metaphorical. And that's not something that I can come up with. You'd have to be inspired to know what those second meanings are. And then I think maybe the lesson for us is to see and appreciate the relationship between what Stuart and Fee call orthodoxy and orthopraxy. Orthodoxy is believing the right things. Orthopraxy is practicing the right things. It does you no good to believe the right things if you don't practice the right things. And you can also say that you won't practice the right things if you don't believe the right things. So that perhaps is the most important lesson that we can learn from the prophets. There's a relationship between belief and practice. It's a relationship that Jesus talked about. Out of the abundance of the heart, man speaks. It's not the things that go into a man that defile him, but the things that come out of a man's heart. Those are the things that defile a man. So, if that's my understanding of the prophets, there's more that can be said, and we could talk about this a great deal, and we're not going to have the time that Ted has to go into it like he's going into just one book, Jeremiah. Ted has, I think, rightly said for us to get the information from Jeremiah is going to take months, not just 1 hour of discussion. But I think these are some general guidelines that we can use as we read through Jeremiah or as we read through any of the other prophets to try to understand the message that we're supposed to see for us, Eugene, in the 21st century, that comes from what the prophets said. So I've talked a lot tonight. I didn't give anybody a chance really to respond to anything that I've said. And I'm sure that there are people that have been Christians for a long time and they have something that they could add to our discussion. Anyone have anything that would be useful to add?